Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. The Solomon Islands Police says a reward offer for information about an attack on a boat indicates they are extremely serious about finding those responsible. In December 2014, a vessel chartered by politicians was shot at and set on fire at Embaik Island in Central Province on the eve of the election of the Prime Minister. Five people have been committed to trial, which is due to start next year, but police investigations have been plagued by delays. The commissioner, Frank Prendergast, told Corey Hawkins he hopes the reward, up to $12,000, will entice people who are withholding information to come forward.
This is the first time we've done it in relation to this investigation. I'm not sure whether these sorts of rewards have been issued previously in the Solomon Islands, but it's not a normal step that we take. We're taking it because this is a extremely serious case. We've said all along that we won't leave any stone unturned in identifying who's been involved in this activity, and operationally the reward is warranted and it's the right time to issue it.
The reward is conditional, I understand, and obviously if people aren't coming forward, there must be some concern around safety issues. Is that being catered for as well?
Look, we believe from our inquiries that there are people in the community who have information about this matter who haven't come forward. The reward's designed to attract those people to come forward and provide that information so we can deal with it. We've been receiving good support from the community to date, but clearly we believe there's other information out there that we haven't been given. So that's the reason for the reward. The reward is conditional. We're paying the reward based on prosecution rather than just for information. And as I said, we're very committed to making sure this case is fully investigated and those people involved in the activity, which if you recall, Corey, was very, very serious criminal activity, put in front of the courts.
My other question, sorry, put in there was there might be a issue of personal safety concerns from informants in this regard. Is that being thought of and looked after as well?
Yes, it has. We've set up our reward line in a very secure way. If people have information, we urge them to call. If they've got concerns with their security, we're happy to discuss that with them and deal with that appropriately. But it's important, I think, for the community to realise that we all need to deal with these issues, and it's everyone's responsibility to make sure that the people who are involved in these sort of issues do confront the court. It's very important for the future security of the country. The type of activity that occurred, the type of criminal activity is totally unacceptable in a democracy, and it's incumbent on all of us to do our piece. So we've been trying to work with the community and we've been getting good support, but clearly we believe there's people out there who still have information that they haven't shared with us.
Now, this incident was on the Sun Express in Beaker Island a day before the prime ministerial elections, and MPs were chartering the boat. So are you treating it as a politically motivated crime? Is that a thing?
Yes, I don't want to go into too much detail about the case at this stage, Corey, because we do have people before the courts. But clearly we believe the motivation was to impact the election of Prime Minister the following day.
And was it successful in doing that, do you think?
I don't believe it was.
There are hopes that in American Samoa, the United States Department of Defense will change its stance and help with the restoration of the former Army fuel storage site that has condemned soils. The American Samoa Power Authority wants to put sanitation and water supply systems through the area, but its executive director, Ute Abe Male, told Don Wiseman something first has to be done about the contaminated ground.
This area, Na'ua, was where the fuel tanks used to be located, and this was circa World War II. At that time, this island, Tutuila, was used as a staging area for the army to send the troops over to the Solomon Islands. In that kind of operation, there was spillage, and of course in those days there weren't too many environmental restrictions or regulations in place. What happened is there's oil in the ground there. We know that because every now and then when we were doing some work excavation area, we'd come upon oil. And it's the responsibility of the military, the Department of Defense, to look after cleaning up these areas under what's called, there's a FUDS program, Formerly Used Defense Sites. So we asked them, they need to come and investigate and see if they can clean it up, because we have this rather large sewer project for that area. We want to sewer those villages. It's pretty densely populated, and we want to protect the groundwater and protect the ocean too from bacterial contamination. It's too risky for us to be digging around in the area when there's oil in the ground, because that would add a lot of cost to our projects, add millions of dollars, because you can't just pump out the groundwater, contaminated groundwater, and just have it flow in the ocean. Now we have to truck it out and treat the oil. So we would like the Department of Defense to come and take a look and investigate and see what the cost is. And there is a cost to this. We'd like them to help in paying for it and correcting this problem before we start going. And we cannot issue a contract with the company. There's too much risk in terms of the cost escalating.
When you say that if you're digging, there's oil there, you mean there are great pools of oil?
No, there are no great pools of oil. It's that you have them seeping. It doesn't matter how much oil there is, but we need to know how much oil there is down there. First of all, it's spillage from the operations in those days. There was not much control, environmental control in place.
You have had the Corps of Engineers come down from Hawaii. They've had a very brief look, and they've said it's fine, but that's clearly not the case.
No, it's not the case. And there's also other areas. You're here at the airport. That's where a lot of this junk was dumped here at the airport. See, that was the MO in those days after the war. I understand from around the Pacific, well, there was just dump stuff off the side of the reef. And this was the reef area where our airport is. And there's also, I don't know, I hope there's no ordnance down there, but it's just junk there that they need to come and check and clean it out before the airport can use the land. You know, the airport is afraid to use it land there when there may be junk underneath that's hazardous.
It actually sounds like a huge job that they'd need to do. They'd need to presumably scrape all the soil away and replace it, wouldn't they?
In Aua, I think they would need to do some tests first to see what is the extent of the contamination, and then they would have to use interceptor trenches to collect the possible contamination and clean it.
The leader of an opposition party in Fiji says public order rules around meetings have become more draconian and are designed to stop the opposition doing its job and keeping in touch with his electorate. The National Federation Party's Bimen Prasad told Sally Rown the party had to get a permit for an internal committee meeting at the weekend, and it contained new and more stringent conditions. He says members are being scared off from attending party meetings.
So this meeting was held in the NFP headquarters, which is a private place, and the meeting was through invitation, and it was comprised of working committee members from different branches in the country. We were given a permit to have about 50 people, and the conditions of the permit are also of concern to us.
And the conditions were?
One of the conditions of the permit was that the event organizers are to confine the activities to the objectives of the event and abstain from remarks which can be defamatory, inciting, or provoking. Who defines what is insightful or provoking? What do you mean by provoking? So these are draconian measures to stifle the opposition from holding meetings and getting their views across to the people. I mean, these sort of requirements send a very chilling effect to the members of the public. Many of our members are scared. You know, they're afraid of attending meetings. And the first thing they ask now is whether we have a permit.
This was the first time that sort of language appeared on a permit, those conditions?
This is the first time that we've got a permit which has got this provision, which talks about abstention from remarks which can be defamatory, inciting, provoking. I mean, where in a democracy would you have something like this?
So when you have meetings now in future within the party, are you having to apply for a permit each time?
Yeah, we really have no choice. We have to apply for permit each time. I mean, the police will take us and lock us up again. I mean, this has not happened before. This is the new definition that the police seem to be applying and requesting political parties to apply for permits for their own party activities. And yet, you have the Fiji First government, ministers and everyone going around wherever they want to go, say whatever they want to. They're not required to have permits. These commune decrees are only being applied to the opposition members, and in this particular way, to stop us from doing our work as elected members of parliament.
You must hold meetings on a daily basis within the party headquarters. You're not applying for permits every time there, are you?
Well, I mean, now it appears that if we are having any formal meeting, whether it's a working committee, whether it's a management board, whether it's a strategy committee, whether it's a publicity committee, we would be required to have permits. If we don't, then we could be arrested and charged. This is what the police has been saying. Basically, the political parties have been stopped from engaging in their own legitimate, you know, activities, which is going around the country, meeting people and meeting the members and constituents to discuss issues of concern.
And even if this is held in a private environment?
Well, again, our understanding is that, you know, permits should not be required in case of meeting in a private place. But they also say that if issues of national concern are being discussed, you know, even if you have more than 3 members, you need to have a permit. So unless there is further clarification, it appears that this government is hell-bent on stopping any kind of political activity by the opposition.
The father of Visika Soko, who died after being raped by police while in custody in Fiji, says the prison sentences given to his son's assailants were lenient. 8 police officers and his soldiers were given gaol time between 7 and 9 years on Tuesday at the High Court. The father, Jeremiah Soko, told Ben Robinson Drawbridge that his family intends to pursue compensation.
4 years have been taken off their sentences because of mitigation. They were given a lenient sentence, ranging from 7 years, 8 years, and 9 years only. So in a way, I'm satisfied that finally they are been sentenced and will be sent to jail. They will not come out after 5 years serving in the prison. And for me personally, I thank God that at least my family can have some peace at this time, and I feel for the families of these police officers and the army officer who have gone in now. For me personally, I think it is so important to realize that no one is above the law. These police people who were supposed to be protecting the laws of Fiji, they are the ones who killed my son. Now, although they have been sentenced, the court seems to be lenient on that, but we can't do much at this stage. But for my family, we will be taking legal action against the government for compensation's sake. For the alleged killing of my son, because he was just 30 years old when he died in the August 2014.
Do you hope that today's sentencing could change the culture within the police force?
It may be or may not be, because although they sometimes say something for the public to hear, and sometimes they may do something else, and unless they're taken to task, and this kind of things will be revealed. But otherwise, if the media is not informed, they may just carry on with their own brutality for people who are still to be taken to court. Although it is said that our justice system is okay, but still it is questionable. Police are taking the law into their own hands now. They bring disgrace to the police force and also to the army. But overall, it is good that the world should know of the true situation in Fiji, and I'm looking forward to see the outcomes of this kind of things in days and months and years ahead, to see how these people will be dealt with the law.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from the studios of PCJ Radio International. The Health Association in Kiribati is successfully helping to change negative attitudes towards sexual health and rights and the use of contraceptives. Representatives from the Kiribati Family Health Association, or KFHA, recently spoke at the Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights Conference held in Wellington, New Zealand, on the challenges they face in raising awareness and educating families in their communities. Indira Stewart has more.
10 years ago, sexually transmitted infections were a critical health issue in Kiribati. A World Health Organization survey in 2006 showed increasing incidence of both STIs and HIV in the country, with chlamydia being endemic among both pregnant women and seafarers. It also showed increasing rates of teenage pregnancy. Tamoa Moanata says people in Kiribati are generally not aware of their sexual health and rights, but the association has been working hard to change that.
We have done an awareness programs with the communities. We have carried out the consultations with the traditional leaders, counselors, heads of households, a group of women and young people.
Ms. Moanata says religious beliefs have led to more modern forms of contraception being considered sinful among locals. She says the Billings ovulation method, which helps women monitor their fertility by using colourful beads that track their menstrual cycle, is the only method accepted by the Catholic Church, to which most Kiribati belong to.
The Catholic women and also the men, they found it very easy to use it because, you know, in this cyclopes, it has different colours and they know colours that they will fertilise eggs.
Abitara Tekeke says the association has pushed towards engaging more men in their programs to help improve access to family planning.
Men are the boss in the family and they are the one that take control. So right now we are trying to target them and try to get them to really know what really, especially the benefits, what are the benefits that they will get out from this sexual reproductive health and right, and to allow women, at least they give them a room to discuss and what best that we believe in the family planning, that women's roles are very important in the family.
Mr. Tekeke says the only way they've been able to implement programs on sexual and reproductive health and rights in rural areas is by approaching village chiefs and using a holistic program that addresses health and well-being.
We developed an SP that covered everything, every aspect of their life, like not only health, but also development, peace, and also to preserve the environment. And then we integrate health as part of it. And in that way, they accepted it. And they see that, it's a very important.
Mr. Tekeke says the success of convincing rural chiefs allowed them to implement their programs into the wider communities.
So we approach from the top, from the leaders. Then when we get the permission, we go to the men, who is the head of household. After that, we go to the women. And the last, with the youth groups.
Mr. Tekeke says winning over the men is key.
Men are listening to men. We have a role that's very important for our, not only for our family, but for the nation. Because it's all about our choice. Because you are the first one to give authority and to authorize everything that you think the best for you and for your country.
With the Health Ministry's support, GIFA has further trained another 20 community educators who are continuing to build networks and mobilising the strategic plans that are being implemented in communities. This is Indira Stewart.
Tonga's democratically elected government, the first in its history, is now 2 years into a four-year term, but it remains concerned at its ability to implement its program. Most recently, the Prime Minister Akasili Pavavidi said the real change as a result of his government reforms is yet to happen. He also talked about being hamstrung by some senior officials being appointed by the Privy Council rather than the government. Dr. Sravintri Hapu, an academic and former close colleague of the Prime Minister in his previous parliament, spoke to Don Wiseman, who asked him why the government seems to be struggling.
The first point, they're struggling with the implementation of what they want. They realize that power
itself is necessary but not sufficient. And the second point is they're struggling with trying to find a common ground and a direction so that they all agree about where they're taking the country forward.
They've got no idea of political compromise, you mean?
Yes. And the reason being, and that was something that needs to be done prior to the formation of the government. It's not something that you wait until you form the government and then start the process of compromise and negotiation. Of course, there are things you have to do after the formation of government to carry out compromise. But the more fundamental negotiation compromise is done before the formation. For instance, you have to agree on what are the major policy that you all need to pursue, major policy, or differences that need to be compromised and agreed on those different policy. There was none whatsoever, as far as I know, and I remember. That was decided after they formed the government.
In terms of some of the difficulties that Akilisi has talked about, and he talks about how there are a number of office holders who are appointed by the Privy Council and he doesn't have control over them, they're not the people he wants, so therefore he takes an adversarial approach towards them, it seems.
That's not true, because the main policy holders that are responsible for implementing policy and carrying out the work for the country are the minister themselves and the prime minister. They are the main office holders responsible for the day-to-day running of government. The policy holder he's probably speaking about is a reference to the judiciary system. And we haven't seen a situation where the judiciary system in Tonga become problematic and responsible for the problem we're facing now. And I think it's kind of passing on the buck and challenging the power of the king, because that side of the equation, you know, the king is responsible for. But I'm talking about the government and the ministers and senior officials responsible for the day-to-day running of the government. That's what I'm talking about. And you cannot pass on the buck. Because, you know, as the American saying is, the buck stopped there. It stopped at the Prime Minister and his cabinet. You cannot pass it on to somebody else.
In terms of compromise and this ability to work with people and so on, are you surprised that someone with a long political run like Akilisi Pohiva has had, that he hasn't acquired that?
Well, it doesn't really surprise me, because, you know, he genuinely and effectively struggled, but that struggle really occurred outside the system, if you like. It was not really a struggle. He was in the system, but the struggle itself mainly took place outside. So probably when you see things from outside, you might have simplistic views about how things work. When you are inside and you raise the expectation of the people, and you are expected, not only by the people, by the constitution and the king himself, his majesty, to work and act in accordance with the laws of the country. And that's where a problem can arise. Because when you're outside, you're struggling, you don't really care about the rule and the law, because you think and believe that the rules and the laws are injustice. That is a very different thing from when you are inside the government and you are expected. There's no two way about it. You have to work in accordance to the constitution, according to the law and the regulations. And that is very difficult for a person who is not used to it or never had that experience before. You know, that person is quite likely to begin to think that the laws are really constraints on what you are trying to achieve. You cannot really think like that if you are in government. Maybe you can think like that when you're outside, but not in government.
It's 2 years through their term. Do they have enough time and the wherewithal to turn things around and present themselves positively going into the next election?
Well, you can try, but I think there's not enough time for that, because the first 12 months, or even should be, as the American put it, the first 100 days, that's when you put the direction for the country and where you want to be. That's, you know, the first 100 days or the first 6 months, you know, the most. But now we are in the 12 months period to try to set the direction on where you want to go and what you want to be for the country in the remaining 2 years. To me, it's too late, because by the time you come to the realization about the direction you're going, you are ready for the next election.
So I don't think the time and the opportunity is there for the next 2 years.
So the possibility is that Tonga could end up with a Noble-led government next time round.
Well, we'll see how it goes, but that is a high, very high possibility, a likelihood. Because I must say, I don't claim to listen to parliament debates all the time, but the few debates I listen to, I'm quite impressed with the performance of the nobles. Not just because they are nobles, but probably because they do their homework. I think people representatives have yet to rise to that level.
The Asian Development Bank says further refinement of business registrations in Solomon Islands should foster economic activity and create more jobs all over the country. The ADB's Pacific Private Sector Development Initiative, or PSDI, says applications for foreign investment licenses and business name registrations can now be logged online and processed in 24 hours, thanks to an upgrade of the Solomon Islands Business Registry. The registry, which has been accepting online applications for company registration since 2010, has now expanded so that applications for foreign investment licenses and business name registrations can also be logged. The PSDI's Aaron Levine spoke from Honiara and explained the update to Don Wiseman.
What we've done is we've extended what was in place from an earlier project where we put company registrations online. And obviously that caters to one particular market for those wanting to set up relatively, you know, larger businesses. So we've now got business names online, and they are typically the type of business license used by smaller businesses, sole traders, people all around the country. And we saw that when they were doing a paper registration, it was very slow and very cumbersome. So now they can efficiently fill out their forms online. What we've also done is we've brought the foreign investment registration process online. So that's going to really help out those foreign investors who have some interest in investing in the Solomon Islands. And we think the new brand called Invest Solomons, people will have a really positive first impression when they're looking at doing business in the country.
This process started with these registrations, I think, 4 years ago. So what have you noticed in the intervening 4 years?
So what we noticed was it immediately took down the time required to register a new company from around a month to just 1 day. And we also saw a doubling of the number of new companies registering every year compared to the time before the reform. So what we're hoping to see is that, you know, that we see some kind of increased activity on the foreign investment front and on the business name registration front as well. What's really important for foreign investment is we want to be able to attract really good quality foreign investment as well that's going to make a genuine development contribution to the country, create jobs, bring capital and bring knowledge. And we hope with this reform that will be more possible as well.
Doesn't it make it harder to police if it's done so quickly?
So it's an interesting question. What's actually happening is we're not cutting down any of the safeguards in the process. What we're doing is cutting out things like the postal service in the process. So the same information has to be provided that you would have had to provide by paper, but instead it's now just going direct to the office online. The officers then scrutinise the application in the same way that they would if it was paper. But if there's a problem with it, what they can do is immediately go back to the customer who's notified by email and say, provide some more information and reassess. So if anything, it's going to make it more efficient without compromising the quality.
So your organisation then, the Pacific Private Sector Development Initiative, would see this as a huge plus for what is really and has been for many years a struggling commercial sector in Solomon Islands.
PSDI, as part of the Asian Development Bank, really hopes to see is exactly that, continuing step by step to take away these barriers to doing business in the country. We would love to see this increase economic activity and create more jobs all over the country.
And with that, we end this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. For everyone at PCJ Radio International, I'm Keith Powell. So long, take care. Bye-bye.